Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 340, titled Mind Jihad, Islamofascism and Geopolitics. This is being recorded on December 9th of the year 2001, and this is yet another program in the ongoing series about the events in and around the attacks of September 11th. This is a complex event. I do not have time either in this hour or the other programs to cover it in its entirety. That's why it's an ongoing series. In order to properly set the context, one must take advantage not only of the World Wide Web, but also of a tape duplication service that I will tell you about later in the program, time permitting. At the outset, let me stress that in using the term Islamofascism, I do not want to be misunderstood as characterizing Islam as fascist. That is not the case. However, there is a powerful element in the worldwide Islamic community that is fascist and that is in turn inextricably linked with the worldwide fascist community. And it is that element of Islam that we are going to be focusing on in this discussion of Islamofascism. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article that appeared in the New York Times of Tuesday, December 4th of the year 2001. This is an article by Douglas Jahl, J-E-H-L. Its dateline, Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, headlined, An Ambassador's Journey from Rome to Mecca. And this deals with Torquato Cardilli, C-A-R-D-I-L-L-I, the ambassador of Silvio Berlusconi to the Saudi Arabian government. Silvio Berlusconi, an Italian fascist, member of the P2 Lodge, and an individual who has brought the Italian neo-fascist elements into a coalition government in Italy. And this is by way of launching the discussion of Islamofascism. And again, do not misunderstand me as characterizing Islam as fascist. But as is the case with elements of the Zionist movement, there is a fascist heritage within elements of Islam, as there is to the Israeli right wing. Not Israel, not Zionism, but the Israeli right wing. Turning to the New York Times of Tuesday, December 4th of 2001, we read of Torquato Cardilli, the Italian ambassador to Saudi Arabia. In Saudi newspapers, there have been dark allusions to Western bias and to the, quote, circles, unquote, in the American media that might be trying to torpedo the Saudi reputation. Crown Prince Abdullah, the country's day-to-day leader, has lashed out repeatedly at the kingdom's critics, charging that, quote, those newspapers and those who stand behind them are actually attacking our faith, unquote. Reading between the lines, this sounds very much like the Jewish-controlled news media, unquote, that one hears within the worldwide fascist community, and also from certain elements of the so-called progressive sector in this country. Continuing, little wonder, then, that the government-controlled Saudi press has now taken time to seize on a different kind of news. The ambassador from Italy, it was announced almost gleefully this week, has converted to Islam. And this, again, Mr. Torquato Cardilli, the ambassador of the basically neo-fascist government of P2 Lodge member Silvio Berlusconi, the wealthiest man in Italy. Now, by way of developing some of the historical background to the connections between fascism and Islamic fundamentalism, that nexus being what I refer to as Islamofascism, it's important to understand the influence on the worldwide Islamic fundamentalist movement of the disciples of Abu Ali. That's spelled capital A-B-U, capital A-L-I. Now, that is a name that will not be known to many listeners, so I'm going to set the context for the discussion of the disciples of Abu Ali right now. We're going to turn to the book The Beast Reawakens by Martin A. Lee, published in hardcover by Little Brown, copyright 1997. Of the fascist movements in Middle Eastern nations or colonial territories in the pre-World War II and World War II period, Egypt in particular, Martin Lee writes, even though he loathed Arabs, he once described them as, quote, lacquered half-apes who ought to be whipped, unquote. Hitler was nonetheless the idol of the paramilitary Green Shirts, Egypt's indigenous proto-fascist movement, which referred to Hitler as Abu Ali, the good fighter, unquote. King Farouk, who ruled Egypt during the Hitler era, was also a Nazi sympathizer. The king's palace became a rendezvous point for Axis spies and couriers, Members of the royal family were involved in espionage for fascist Italy, and many of the king's mistresses did double duty as Nazi agents. With Rommel's army aiming to wrest Egypt from British colonial rule, German military intelligence stepped up its activities in the land of the Sphinx. Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, chief of the Abwehr, counted among his confidential agents two young Egyptian lieutenants, Abdel Nasser and Anwar Sadat, both of whom belonged to a secret officers' association known as the Ring of Iron. Quote, "We made contact with the German headquarters in Libya," unquote, Sadat said of his wartime activities, again quoting, "and we acted in complete harmony with them," unquote. Imprisoned for 3 years by the British because of his subversive efforts, Sadat would later succeed Nasser as president of Egypt. So that, again, is the reference to Abu Ali. That was the Egyptian fascist movement's name for Adolf Hitler. And by the way, one of the translations of jihad, best known as being translated as holy war, is struggle. Hence the title of this broadcast, Mind Jihad. Now later, when Colonel Nasser overthrew King Farouk and became head of Egypt, he turned to the Central Intelligence Agency in order to get his Egyptian espionage service and general staff trained. And we talked about the fact that in turn the CIA turned to the Reinhard Gehlen Nazi spy outfit and SS post-war underground Odessa chief Otto Skorzeny. We talked about this connection at great length in For the Record program number 22, available from Spitfire. And specifically, we accessed information from E.H. Cookrich's Galen Spy of the Century, and also from the book Skorzeny, Hitler's Commando by Glenn Infield. Of the CIA / Reinhard Gehlen / Otto Skorzeny mission on behalf of CIA to Egypt, and in turn, their mobilization of notorious Nazi war criminals in order to serve Nasser, Martin Lee writes as follows in The Beast Reawakens. The CIA gladly assented to Nasser's request for assistance in overhauling the mothballed Egyptian espionage apparatus. Such a sensitive assignment, however, required that American advisors not get their hands dirty. An off-the-shelf style of nation tampering was deemed preferable, so the CIA turned to the readily available Gehlen organization. Skipping down, after conferring with Alan Dulles, Gehlen decided that the best man for the job was Otto Skorzeny. The CIA chief concurred, confident in the presumption that Skorzeny, an ardent anti-communist, would help solidify Nasser's power base within the Egyptian military. Skorzeny was a, quote, particular favorite of American counterintelligence, having made friends with several of his captors before escaping from them, and was believed to be especially suited in temperament and personality for getting along with Nasser, remarked CIA officer Miles Copeland. It was a decision that U.S. policymakers would come to regret. By the way, I would add that as we looked at in For the Record program number 283, the Skorzeny mission was actually run at an executive level by former Gestapo chief Heinrich Müller, working as the security director for the remarkable and deadly Bormann organization. And in turn, later, the Müller / Skorzeny contingent put together the Libyan Secret Service for Muammar Gaddafi. Continuing. At first, Skorzeny played hard to get. He was approached in a routine manner, wrote Copeland, again quoting, then at a higher level, then through a personal visit from a certain well-known major general of the American Army, unquote. In the end, it took some diligent persuasion by Hjalmar Schacht, the former Nazi finance minister, to convince his nephew-in-law that it would be in everyone's best interest if he swaggered off to the pyramids on a mission for Gehlen and the Americans. Skorzeny accepted the assignment after he was assured that his stay in Egypt would be limited and that the CIA would supplement the salary offered by Nasser. Over the next year and a half, Skorzeny used CIA funds to recruit a slew of SS veterans and other Third Reich luminaries who jumped at the chance, quote, to inject new life and expertise into the Egyptian Secret Service, unquote, as Gehlen put it. More than 100 additional German advisors were pressed into service under Skorzeny's auspices. Some were drawn from the ranks of neo-Nazi organizations and remnants of the Odessa escape networks that crisscrossed through Madrid. By the way, the Odessa is the post-World War II SS underground. Continuing. Skorzeny's team included fugitives like SS Major Leopold Gleim, who had been sentenced to death for wartime atrocities committed while he was the Gestapo chief of Poland, and Franz Bunch, a Goebbels propagandist best known for his pornographic book, The Sexual Habits of Jews. Miles Copeland of the CIA took it all in stride. Quote, "Perhaps someone will one day devise a means for inducing gentlemen of finer sensibilities to become security officers, but certainly no such means were known, either by Nasser or his American advisors," unquote. And skipping down of this Skorzeny mission to Egypt on behalf of Galen and CIA, we're going to take a look at some of the liaisons that were formed by this group of basically Nazi war criminals and fascists in Egypt. And one of the main names here is that of the Grand Mufti, himself a major in the SS, the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement, an individual who wields profound influence on the contemporary Islamo-fascist movement, even though he died in 1974. His World Muslim Congress, funded in large measure by the Saudis, was one of the principal organs used against the Soviet Union in the Afghan War of the 1980s, and in that capacity it liaised closely with U.S. intelligence. It was that war that saw the genesis of Osama bin Laden as a warrior. Continuing. During the post-Farouk era, the Grand Mufti held court at a closely guarded villa on Sharia Asweet Street in Heliopolis, a suburb of Cairo. There, he entertained delegations from throughout the Arab world while maintaining close contact with radical nationalists from Germany and other countries. Among those who gathered at the Mufti's home during the mid-1950s was his distant cousin, Yasser Arafat, then an engineering student at the University of Cairo. Raymer, that's Otto Ernst Raymer, himself a key SS man and war criminal, Raymer, who would collaborate with Arafat in the years ahead, also visited the esteemed Gross Mufti on several occasions. Over cups of strong Arabian coffee, they shared fond recollections of Adolf Hitler and indulged in the usual talk of driving the Jews into the sea. The Grand Mufti's network of sympathizers extended far and wide. Quote, "I did a couple of jobs for him, getting some documents from files that would are otherwise unavailable," unquote, recalled H. Keith Thompson. By the way, H. Keith Thompson is the Yale-educated Sicherheitsdienst agent who became one of the prime functionaries of the post-World War II fascist underground, and who also worked very closely with Francis Parker Yockey, about whom we'll have a bit more to say later on in the program, a remarkable and encyclopedic biography of Francis Parker Yockey, Dreamer of the Day by Kevin Coogan, is one of the very best books ever written about fascism, and an absolutely indispensable work for understanding not only fascism in the 20th century, but in particular Islamo-fascism and its connection to the post-war fascist international. Returning to Martin A. Lee's discussion of the Grand Mufti, his liaising with Otto Skorzeny and Yasser Arafat, we read, "The Grand Mufti's network of sympathizers extended far and wide. Quote, I did a couple of jobs for him, getting some documents from files that were otherwise unavailable," recalled H. Keith Thompson. Otto Skorzeny also collaborated with the Muslim religious leader. According to AFX Baron, a prominent British fascist, Skorzeny was instrumental in funneling more than $1 million, which the Mufti had raised for anti-Zionist and anti-Jewish propaganda, to various neo-Nazi groups around the world. Several German propaganda experts adopted Arabic names when they emigrated to Egypt. Johann von Leers, one of the Third Reich's most prolific Jew baiters, converted to Islam and became Omar Amin. He got a job with the Egyptian Information Ministry thanks to the good offices of the Gross Mufti. With von Leers in charge, Cairo's anti-Israeli propaganda machine churned out hate literature and inflammatory broadcasts on a regular basis. Assisting von Leers were dozens of European Nazis who welcomed a fresh opportunity to continue their vendetta against the Jews. They had regular access to Radio Cairo, which utilized a powerful CIA-constructed transmitter to spread the message throughout much of the Arab world. And by the way, I'm going to take just a minute here to review a couple of articles that we looked at in For the Record program number 335. If it seems that we're straying a little bit far afield, let's review a little bit from the Financial Times of Friday, November 9th of the year 2001. An article by Hugh Williamson and Philip Jacklin in Berlin headlined, Far Right Has Ties with Islamic Extreme. Now remember Johann von Leers, we're going to come back to him. One of the people identified by the U.S. government as providing financial support to the Al-Qaeda terrorist network is also a well-known figure in the European far-right political movement. The link is likely to raise new concerns over ties between Islamic and right-wing extremists. Ahmed Huber, a 74-year-old Swiss businessman and former journalist who converted to Islam in the 1960s, is a board member of NADA Management, a financial services and consultancy company which is part of the international Al-Taqwa Group. The U.S. says this group has long acted as financial advisors to Al-Qaeda. Mr. Huber, who is based in Bern, is known in Switzerland and Germany as an Islamic fundamentalist who attempts to forge links to far-right and neo-Nazi movements. A spokesman for Germany's Office for the Protection of the Constitution, the Internal Intelligence Agency, said yesterday that Mr. Huber, quote, sees himself as a mediator between Islam and right-wing groups, unquote. He also belongs to the revisionist movement which believes the Holocaust did not take place, the spokesman said. Klaus Beyer, spokesman for the NPD, one of Germany's main far-right political parties, said Mr. Huber has often addressed NPD events. And by the way, as we looked at in For the Record program number 335, the NPD has as its top, that's the top German so-called neo-Nazi party, it has as its top American liaison organization, the National Alliance, the parent organization of National Vanguard Books, which publishes Serpent's Walk and the Turner Diaries. Continuing. Mr. Huber confirmed that he had contact with associates of Osama bin Laden at an Islamic conference in Beirut. He is quoted in the Swiss media as saying that these people, quote, are very discreet, well-educated, very intelligent people, unquote. And reviewing another article that we looked at in For the Record program number 335, by way of setting some of the background of Ahmed Huber, this is from the website www.phdn.org/negation/folisson/rami.html. This was authored by Gilles Camassin and was copyright 2000. Of the background of Ahmed Huber, nay, Alfred Huber, and his liaison with a Swedish-based Islamic fundamentalist and anti-Semite and Holocaust denier, I'm going to read this in French and then translate it. Depuis son arrivée en Suède, Rami est très lié à l'islamiste pro-Nazi suisse Ahmed Huber. Converti à l'islam au début des années 1960, Ahmed Huber côtoie dans l'Égypte nazarien d'anciens nazis dont, principalement, l'ancien bras droit de Goebbels pour la propagande antisémite Johann von Leers, lui aussi converti à l'islam sous le nom d'Omar Amin von Leers. Now in English, since his arrival in Sweden, Rami is very closely associated with the pro-Islamic, with the not Islamic pro-Nazi Swiss Ahmed Huber. Converted to Islam at the beginning of the 1960s, Ahmed Huber was associated in Nasser's Egypt with old Nazis, among whom principally the old right-hand man of Goebbels for anti-Semitic propaganda, Johann von Leers, himself also converted to Islam under the name Omar Amin von Leers. So that, again, by way of jumping forward to the present and the world of Al-Qaeda, now back to Nasser's Egypt, which saw the genesis of Ahmed Huber. Taking a cue from von Leers, Hans Oppler, another Goebbels protege, changed his name to Salah Shafar when he started preparing anti-Semitic material for the Nasser regime. And Louis Haydn, alias Louis Alhaj, a wartime employee of the German press agency, pitched in by translating Hitler's Mein Kampf into Arabic. The Egyptian government also published an Arabic version of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, the infamous forgery concocted by the Tsarist secret police, which Nasser recommended to a visiting Indian journalist in 1958. Quote, It is very important that you should read it, unquote, the Egyptian president explained, again quoting, I will give you a copy. It proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that 300 Zionists, each of whom knows all the others, govern the fate of the European continent, unquote. Prior to World War II, vicious European-style anti-Semitism, as typified by the protocols, was uncommon in the Arab world. While Jews were often discriminated against, they were rarely persecuted. But this began to change when Nazi propagandists assumed key positions inside the 10-story building that housed the Information Ministry in Cairo. Inevitably, the racialist views of these German expatriates rubbed off on Egypt's leaders, who launched a repressive campaign against members of the local Jewish community, many of whom were expelled from the country after their property and possessions had been confiscated. Such measures were applauded by von Leers and the other European fascists who found favor with Nasser in the mid-1950s. The Nazis on the Egyptian government payroll were engaged in more than just a war of words. According to the Times of London, in addition to serving as advisors to the Egyptian army, German war veterans were also instructing Arab volunteers in guerrilla tactics for possible action against British troops in the Suez Canal zone. The Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung subsequently reported that Otto Skorzeny had met with Colonel Nasser to discuss the training of commando troops. Several young Palestinian refugees, including Yasser Arafat, joined the Egyptian soldiers who were learning the ways and means of unconventional warfare. Although initially the intended target was the British, the future PLO chief realized that rigorous commando exercises would help prepare the Palestinian militants who were eager to renew the battle for their lost homeland. A grateful Arafat recognized Skorzeny's abundant skills in this area, and the two men struck up a relationship that lasted for many years. Apparently, the Palestinian leader was quite fond of the scar-faced paladin, quote, Arafat would have done anything for Otto, remarked Ilse Skorzeny. We're going to return to the Middle East and the Nasser contingent under Skorzeny. However, we're going to review a couple of aspects of, in fact, we're going to take a look at an aspect of Yasser Arafat that is not generally speaking recognized. We're going to turn now to, and the PLO, we're going to turn now to the book The Kingdom, by Robert Lacey. This was published in hardcover by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich, copyright 1981, ISBN number 0-15-147260-2. What we're going to look at is who bankrolls the Palestine Liberation Organization and Yasser Arafat. A hint, it's much the same elements as have bankrolled Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. Saudi reading now from The Kingdom by Robert Lacey. Saudi Arabia is Yasser Arafat's principal financial supporter. Increasing Saudi subsidies to the PLO since 1973 have given the organization currency reserves estimated at over $1 billion, larger than those of many third world countries, and most inhabitants of the kingdom are proud that Saudi oil revenues should be supporting the cause of their Palestinian brothers. But the idea that Saudi Arabia should lend such massive support to men usually seen in the West as terrorists is deeply offensive to many people outside the Muslim world. This support to the Palestinians flatly contradicts in their eyes the word moderate, unquote, so often used by the kingdom's Western friends to describe Saudi international strategy, and this contradiction has lain at the heart of the foreign policy pursued since 1975 by King Khalid, Crown Prince Fahad, and their brothers. And again, the Saudis, the bankrollers of the PLO, which despite the tremendous poverty of most Palestinians, has over $1 billion in foreign currency reserves, and that as of the 1980s, that raises more questions than it answers under the circumstances. One of the reasons why the Saudi funding of the PLO and the Grand Mufti and Otto Skorzeny heritage of Yasser Arafat does not get a great deal of publicity in this country is because of oil and the power politics involved in that. We're going to take a look at an article that appeared in the media this past week, and this was after the Israeli military retaliation for a couple of terror attacks last weekend. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, December 4th of the year 2001. This is an article by James Bennett of the New York Times. It's Dateline Jerusalem, headlined, Israel Strikes at Arafat. Let's take a look at who was the chief spokesperson, at least on this particular event, for Yasser Arafat. Skipping down, there appeared to be no serious casualties in the Israeli assault, but with the pleas of peacemakers in both camps overwhelmed by a roar of violence, both sides were braced for further bloodshed. Note that there were no serious casualties. Saeb Erekat, the Palestinians' chief negotiator, said that Sharon had declared war on the Palestinians, quote, full-out, full-scale war, unquote. And Saeb Erekat is not a name known to most Americans. He is one of the top Palestinian spokespersons. We have, however, dealt with him before, and we're going to turn, as the last item in this side, to the book The Secret War Against the Jews, co-authored by former Justice Department official and U.S. military officer John Loftus, as well as Mark Ahrens. The book was published in soft cover and hardcover by the St. Martin's Press, copyright 1994, and due to the title, it has not gotten a lot of publicity. It is a remarkable book talking about fascism, the petroleum industry, the intelligence community, and the decades-long association among those. Now, of a group of Palestinian, quote, moderates, unquote, who were protégés of former Secretary of State James Baker, associated not only with the Bush family, but the Carlyle group, and through that, the Bin Laden family, we read, the CIA secretly brought several moderate Palestinians to the United States for intensive briefing. This group, codenamed Baker's Dozen, included most of the official Palestinian negotiating team with Israel. Hanan Ashrawi, Hana Senora, Saeb Erekat, Sari Nosebeh, and other lower-ranking Palestinians were summoned to Langley for a 3-day conference on integrating their politics with the U.S. Ashrawi was singled out as a good Palestinian image spokeswoman, dubbed by the company the Palestinian Golda Meir. So if some of the things I'm talking about do not ring familiar to listeners, that is not an accident. We're going to continue with a discussion of Islamofascism and the other side of this program. I've made references to other broadcasts. Those are available from Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, one word. They're located at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-A-S-T.com. And you can visit the Real Audio-equipped Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. There are detailed and annotated descriptions of all of the For the Record programs on the 911 attacks, For the Record 325 through 340 and counting, in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. Sister station WFMU-FM is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. There is another longer URL which has programs for download only on Real Audio. There are links to that URL on both the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website and in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. This concludes side one of Mein Jihad, Islamofascism and Geopolitics. This is For the Record 340, being recorded on December 9th of 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.